Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mehler, and today we're broadcasting from the Green Bay Botanical Garden Society. Green Bay Botanical Garden. I guess a lot of society members are probably here today in the studio with me. A very nice crowd. Thank you all for coming, by the way. Yeah, thank you. And a big thanks to my two guests, Vijay Pandya, who's been with us a number of times. Vijay is the horticulture educator for Brown County with UW Extension. Vijay, welcome back.
Thank you.
And also Lindsay Hendricks, who is the assistant director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And Lindsay, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is my first time on radio, so I'm excited. Well, newbie.
Good. Move the mic closer to you. There you go. You don't have to lean over. You don't have to lean over so far. Well, I tell you what. We Jill Nadeau and I made a little quick tour. You're not going to see this garden in an hour, but we went around and saw quite a bit in an hour, and it looks fabulous. Tell our listeners about the garden.
Well, we have a lot going on here at the garden this year. Anyone who's been has probably seen our grand garden going on in the backyard. That's coming along nicely. We started planting some bigger trees in that area this week. Probably closer to beginning of July, middle of July, we'll start getting our perennials. We have over 11,500 perennials to plant in the Grand Garden. We haven't even received them yet. And we have over 100 trees and shrubs that are going in that garden alone. So be quite busy. Right now we're working on getting a lot of our annuals in the ground. This rain has been helping them grow along quite well. The weeds are growing just as well. So that's been...
I didn't notice any weeds.
We've been doing a good job of hiding them. So things are progressing nicely. We're getting caught up with a lot of our plantings and just kind of, you know, hitting the ground running with everything going on here. So we're, you know, excited it's not 90 degrees anymore. It makes working outside a little bit more enjoyable.
Yeah, but I tell you what, if you live within a couple hundred miles of here, you got to come over and see this place. It is fabulous. It looks just unbelievable, doesn't it, Vijay?
Awesome. This garden has seen a lot of development in the last 10 years. And the Grand Garden, which is going to open up pretty soon, it looks spectacular looking at the plan map. And kudos to the Green Bay Botanical Garden team members for putting all this kind of effort together.
All of the different spaces and places that you can go to within the garden are so interesting. I wish I'd had my Map My Run app going this morning, because I know I walked at least a couple of miles through the gardens and didn't see everything.
Yes, there's definitely a lot to see here, and a lot of visitors that come through the gardens, even some of our members, ask, well, when's the best time to come see the garden? You know, when's the best time? Well, the best time is any time that you can get down here, really, because everything is changing so much on a weekly, daily basis. Even, you know, if you come out once a month, every other week, you know, you're going to see something new blooming. So all throughout the season, spring we have our bulbs, summer we have our annuals, fall we have the pretty fall colors, and then the winter we have the light show. So pretty much throughout the season, whenever you come out here, there's always something to see, always something different to see. And like Vijay had said, you know, there's so much going on at the gardens within the past, you know, 10 years, the new projects and developments and gardens going in, you know, it's always changing.
Yeah, people were raving to me about the light show. I've got to get up here when that comes on. It's not that far, a couple hour drive from Madison, so what the heck? Why not do it?
Yes, definitely. Check it out.
You mentioned trees, and I know, Vijay, throughout Brown County area, you've had some troubles with or some problems relating to trees with the weather that has befallen us.
Yes. I mean, we've been getting hit with the rain every day almost, actually. And last week we had a tornado hitting in the northern part of Brown County, and the wind was about like horrible, 40 to 70 miles per hour. And our extension for office has been running a lot of calls, specifically about tree damage because of the storm. And a lot of street trees and backyard trees, and the branches have been ripped off, and people calling what to do about it. Can I prune those trees? And who can I call, actually, to do all these kind of services and tree trimming? So it's been fairly busy. Plus, the rain is not stopping, actually. You never know when you're going to get next rain again. And a lot of diseases associated with that.
I was going to say that. There's got to be disease now out there.
It's unbelievable. We've been getting this year a lot of questions regarding to anthracnose, which is a fungal disease associated with the tree foliage. And it's been hitting the maples, your oak trees, all sort of things. And plus, with the rain also comes in with powdery mildew. People are seeing all this white talcum powder dusted on their lawn as well as on their nine box, and people are wondering, what shall I do with that? And plus, the garden soil is so bad, it's hard to walk, actually, into the garden. And yesterday, I had a client actually walking in, actually, and into the garden and bringing some rotten tomatoes, actually, that they've been planted 2 weeks ago. It's completely collapsed down. And in fact, 2 days ago, I had a client, actually, who had some problem with arborvitae. They're all wilted, actually, because they're all standing in the standing water. So as you all know, arborvitae are extremely sensitive to wet feet. So yeah, a lot of issues regarding to rain. I know rain is a blessing, but too much rain brings a lot of trouble to the gardeners.
Yeah, so my straw bales are doing good in this kind of situation. My tomatoes and that, and the straw bales are looking really, really good. So I'm happy that I got those bales going again this year.
I mean, I think this year, people who have some raised beds, straw bale gardening, container gardening, they are the luckiest folks, I would say, actually.
Well, let's give everybody a chance to join in. If you're listening, have a question for our guest today, I hope you'll join us. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you know what? If you got a great garden photo, put it up there on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to see those photos and the questions from there as well. And let's take a question from the audience.
Good morning, or good afternoon. No, good morning. My name is Adrian, and I'm from the Shawano area. We've lived in this house for 4 years, and there are two spindly bushes that live in the front yard. They don't do anything. They have green leaves. That's about all that they've ever done. And oftentimes, my partner and I would converse about why anybody would want to put these particular bushes in the yard. They do nothing. Well, and even the neighbors have said, you know, those bushes are cute, but they're uneventful, right? So one day we happened to be looking up in the air and discovered that on the top of one of them, there suddenly is a lilac blossom. And now, since that seems like kind of good news, we would like to know how to invite more. Because one just isn't enough.
So how tall is it?
It's about six to 7 feet.
All right.
Okay. Well, oftentimes it all goes to the pruning concept. So many times, you know, people don't know when is the best time to prune. So if you do prune the shrubs actually in the springtime, you're going to literally remove all the flower buds actually. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, they may not be blooming, and maybe this year they forgot to prune, it seems like, and that's why you're seeing them coming back again with the bloom. Also, the location of the shrub also plays a crucial part, because many of the flowering plants do need some full sun, 6 to 8 hours, because the light is a key factor that triggers the flower bud formation. So maybe as a bush gets taller and taller, it's starting to get some more light, it seems like, you know, that could be another factor. So,
all right. Lindsay, something to add there?
Yeah, I was just going to say the pruning is probably the biggest thing, as well as the lights. Sometimes lilacs, if they're really, really big, a good rejuvenation cut will kind of stimulate new root growth or new stems to grow. And then sometimes that new, more juvenile growth is a little bit more vigorous in terms of the flowering. But pruning, probably like Vijay said, is one of the big things, are not getting enough light.
So after that one is finished flowering, whack that one off at the base, or cut about a third of it out, isn't it? A third, roughly?
Yeah, exactly. One-third principle you need to follow. So, for example, if you do have some large canes coming up, in a probably, you know, thin them down to the ground. So, again, let's say if you have 6 large canes in a year, you can take 2 at the maximum back to the ground. So.
Yeah. We have some callers online. I want to take a call from Watertown next. Let's go to Chris. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I used to have a huge perennial garden, and then, oops, I found out that herds of deer went through my backyard. So much for that. But then I saw a Gerber daisy, and I fell in love. I have been doing so much research about trying to plant Gerber daisies inside. And I have a sunroom that has tons of sun. But I have so much conflicting information about planting Gerber daisies inside and what is best. So I would greatly appreciate information about how I can make these big, wonderful flowers grow inside.
All right. I'm not familiar with that daisy. Gerber daisy? Lindsay, do you have them at here?
I do not have one. I have had experience with them.
Okay.
I know Gerber daisies. I've tried them indoors a couple times. They don't seem to be as happy indoors as they do outdoors, unfortunately. If you're trying to keep it inside as a houseplant, the more sun you can provide it, the better. You know, make sure you're not overwatering it. But they are an annual, so they are a short-lived plant. So sometimes, you know, they might not last as long as you would think they would, especially when they're indoors, they're not getting the bright sunlight, you know, they're not as happy. So what you could do as an option is keep it, you know, in your pot, and you can move your pot outside in the summer during the better growing season. It'll probably be a lot happier out there. And if you keep it closer to your house, hopefully your deer will tend to stay away from it. You can also try spraying liquid fence as a deterrent. It is rather stinky, so, you know, if you're outside enjoying your backyard, your front yard, you know, you will have to smell it, unfortunately. But that's what we use here at the Botanical Garden to help deter deer from our tulip and daffodil bulbs in the spring and also in the fall when we plant a lot of our bulbs. And if there's certain plants that the deer tend to munch on a lot, we will go and spray them, you know, every other week or so, depending on the weather. So as far as Gerber daisies inside particularly, I haven't had much experience with them. I know the brighter light that you can give them, the best. If you have any supplemental lighting that you can put under them so they get, you know, the 6 to 8 hours a day would probably be beneficial. I'm not sure if VJ has any experience with the Gerber daisies.
I don't have much experience with that, generally, and I, as you have said, you know, light is one of the key factors. You know, the plenty of light you can give to the plant, then probably the stronger its growth going to be. Yeah.
If you have a second floor patio and it faces south like I do off my bedroom, I stick my lime tree out there all summer long. And limey's about, what, 6, 7 years old? Got about 6 or 7 limes on it right now. Still going strong, but loves it outside all summer long, especially in that south-facing patio that I've got. So that's what we can do for you, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another question from the audience here.
I'm Jack from Hobart. I have a small dwarf conifer garden that I put in. It's doing well. It was really inspired by the fantastic one they have here. My question is, where can I go to find some of the more exotic species that you really don't run across at the local nurseries?
Well, I could probably steer you in the right direction on that one, because I've had a lot of experience with the dwarf conifer garden. I know one of our donors to the dwarf conifer, Gene and Betty Arndt, he does a lot of searching for a lot of these unique varieties. Some of the places I know locally, he gets some from Stein's. Ivy Trails might have a couple different varieties there, a little bit more unique. But a lot of where we've gotten our conifers for the conifer garden was from a place called Conifer Kingdom. They are an online, you go to conifer kingdom.com, and you can actually shop online there. And I don't think it's quite a local business, but a lot of the really unique ones have come from there. There's also some websites called Broken Arrow Nursery, Clem Song Sparrow, and I think Stanley and Sons is another one where we've gotten a lot of conifers from. So Conifer Kingdom, I know, is the majority of the ones from the conifer garden came from. Otherwise, Gene Arndt, he goes throughout, you know, the area in his travels, and he'll pick up random ones here and there, and we usually do our donation from him. So we don't always know some of his secret sources that he has, but you just kind of have to make your list of what you're looking for. And I would suggest doing like an online search to see some of these places that carry the conifers. A lot of them you can order online if you can't find them locally. And I know Green Bay Nursery also has a lot of conifers as well. They might have, you know, some more unique ones. But if you kind of have your name to kind of look for, you know, that'll probably steer you in the right direction.
Thanks for that question. Talking today with Vijay Pandian, who is the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, and Lindsay Hendricks, who is the assistant director of horticulture here at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here broadcasting today from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Just an absolutely beautiful garden, and on a pretty darn nice day as well, with a great group of people here. You have questions about your garden, the flower garden or the vegetable garden, maybe it's about your trees. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Again, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Barbara, and I live in Fort Atkinson. My question is about cherries and cherry trees this year. Every cherry on the trees, the trees were absolutely loaded, just loaded. But 8 out of 10 had brown spots, rotted spots on them. And every tree I looked at, my friend's 3 trees, my daughter-in-law's tree, all the same. Is that the heat, the weather, the timing?
BJ?
I think you have to blame it on the weather, okay? The rain that we got, and I think it's triggering a lot of diseases. We've been getting a lot of samples, both on cherries and peaches, having bacterial canker diseases as well as some brown rot diseases. These two diseases look kind of similar, but there is a distinct characteristic is that the bacterial canker diseases have some sort of like a oozing sap coming out. So look closer to that, and if you do see some sap oozing out, that's a likely possibility for bacterial canker. If not, sometimes it could also be a brown rot diseases too. But either way, I would highly encourage you, you know, to bring a sample to your local extension office, get it diagnosed. The key is proper diagnosis can able to prevent this infection for next year.
Because not much to do about it this year.
Yeah, pretty much, not much. If you do see some branch dieback happening up, wait till the dry season comes in, and then you can start pruning them. And make sure to disinfect your pruning tool after you're done with your pruning. In the fall, do some good cleanup, actually. If you do see some of those old rotten berries still hanging under the trees, rake them up, remove them up, and trash those things, actually. But send the sample, get it tested so that you know what you're dealing with it, so that next year you can take some proper preventive measures.
Yeah, very good. Let's take a call from Wauwatosa. Christine is online. Christine, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question about dogwood.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I have foamy stuff, white foamy stuff, where all the branches come together. And if I squeeze it, there's a little bug inside. And I'd like to know what that is and how to get rid of it. I did take the hose and kind of give it a good squirt the other day, and they did go away, but then they came back almost with a vengeance, like, we'll show her. So I'm going to take my answer offline then.
I'm kind of thinking of dealing with spittle bug.
Yeah.
just like the name sounds like, you know, it releases this foamy mass, okay, and bubble-like mass. And inside it, this bug likes to habitat. And the foamy thing, it does for 2 things. One, from protection from predators, and second of all, it's nice and cozy inside, you know, it doesn't need to have to dehydrate itself, no? So those are the 2 reasons why it's actually secreting this kind of foamy mass. Now, the bug actually does a minor damage to the plant. It sucks the sap off it. But in terms of any type of major damage, it doesn't do anything like that. So probably the control measures is not a whole lot, so you may want to coexist it, and you may want to amaze about this bug, actually, how it's defending itself, actually, and staying hydrated, actually, you know, so.
Yeah, very, very cool. Thank you for that question. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, Larry. I'm Chris from Appleton.
great to actually see you in person.
Oh.
And I, due to some road expansion, just had a huge elm tree cut down on the east side of my yard, which provided a canopy. It was probably at least 60 years old. So in front of my now very sunny house on the east side, I have about 7 lovely hosta plants that are a nice size, and I'm afraid they're just going to get burnt there. Should I move them right away? Is there a way to make them happy, or, no. or what?
Well, Lindsay, you want to...
Sure. Some hostas, surprisingly, are a little bit more tolerant of the sun than we think. I know VJ with the Extension Office, they did a sun trial garden, sun hosta trial a couple years ago, so he can maybe fill on some good cultivars, but I would probably keep an eye on them and see some of your lighter varieties that have the chartreuse or the white margin leaves might burn a little bit more than some of your solid green, really thick corrugated leaves. So ideally, you know, the summer's not the best time to move a lot of perennials because it's so hot. It stresses the plants out. You know, your hostas are just going to start flowering probably pretty soon, and you really don't want to move a lot of plants during their flowering season. But there are occasions in the garden when, you know, if it's life or death of the plant, you just kind of have to bite the bullet and move it. And thankfully, with all the rain we've been having, you know, we're not in a drought situation yet. So I would maybe wait and keep an eye on them and see how they're doing. Some of the ones that are really starting to sunburn, you'll see brown margins on their leaves or even sun scald, you know, little spots that start dying on the leaves. That's probably a sign that they need to get into some more shade. If you want to wait until the end of the season, you know, you could put up a temporary shade structure in front, you know, put some posts in with some fabric, an old sheet or something on top to provide some temporary shade. It's not going to be pretty probably, but if you want to wait until a little bit towards the end of the season when it might be a little bit better to move those hostas, that is another option. But if
they're pretty tough.
Yeah.
Hostas are tough.
A lot of them will take a lot more sun. I see a lot of houses in Green Bay where they have their hostas in full-on sun all day, and they seem to do just fine. So I'd probably keep an eye on them. If they start looking not so happy, you know, I'd maybe think about moving those ones. But if you have some other ones that are seem to be doing okay, you can probably wait until this fall when it's a better time to move them.
Mm-hmm. VJ, anything to add to that?
Those are excellent suggestions, as Lindsay has said. Maybe, you know, if you feel a little bit hesitant not to move those hostas, maybe think about, you know, planting some fast-growing, you know, shrubs or trees, actually, to replace that area so that, you know, in about a couple of years, it can give you at least some tentative shades, okay? That's another possibility to think about.
Years ago, I had almost the exact same situation with a huge elm tree that we had to take down, and it made about a 10-degree difference in the summertime in the house. It was always comfortable in that house until that elm tree went down, and then the fans had to come out, for sure. Well, let's take another question from the audience, and then we'll go back to the phones.
Hello, my name is Julie, and I'm from Green Bay. I have a question about my swamp white oak. It's about 15 years old, been doing really well, but this year it looks like somebody took a paper punch to the leaves, and there's like these perfect round holes on some of the leaves. I've never seen that before, so I'm curious what's going on.
It might look like maybe a leaf cutter bee, because they do make this perfect crescent shape cut actually on the edges of the leaves actually, and they use those leaves actually to build a nest actually, and so I'm suspecting it might be the leaf cutter bee. You don't have to worry about it, you know, the damage is very minuscule. So, you know, we don't have to spray, or you don't have to be highly concerned about it. Oaks tend to produce some, you know, fresh new leaves back again, so it should be fine.
Actually, maybe the edges are touched, but I was talking about like in the center of the leaves. Would that be like some small larvae?
Sometimes the young leaves, you know, could be also be sensitive to environmental weather conditions. We got a lot of rain, and we have a lot of cold weather early in the springtime too. And we call this symptom as a leaf totter. And leaf totters usually strip the leaves, actually. And that's one possibility. Sometimes, you know, we also still have some gypsy moth caterpillars too, okay, in this area. And they are very active, and they also chew on the leaves too. If not, you know, take a photo shot and send it to us, actually. You can go to www.browncountyextension.org and you can send your pictures, you know, to their website. Perhaps it may give us a better idea, you know, to diagnose it correctly.
All right. Thank you for that question. Let's go back to the phones then to Michael in Green Bay. Hi, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Hi, everyone. I've called in before about my geraniums, and I keep them potted and keep them growing year-round inside and out. I want to just make a funny observation and ask a question. You know, last year it was so nice. They were flowering and beautiful till the end of November outside. And here it's almost July, and they're first starting to flower now, barely, with this goofy weather. So I think maybe a lot of people are kind of experiencing some goofy things with the colder weather and the rain. But the next question is, or the question I have is, I noticed with rainwater, these plants can be flooded day after day, and it seems like they're not affected by that. But when you overwater with city water, that really hurts them. So is there a way to take city water and kind of make it more like rainwater?
Well, what do you think about that, Lindsay?
Well, my take on that, speaking of geraniums, I have some in the cottage garden that I overwinter as well, and sometimes they take cuttings. And they're usually pretty happy right now, but they're not even close to flowering. So I think a lot of that, for one, is all the water that we've been getting, the rain. I know geraniums in particular do like a little more on the dry side conditions, and I do know that they are heavy feeders as well. So making sure you're keeping your geranium fertilized, you know, if it's getting a little too wet outside and it's in a pot, maybe move it to an area that doesn't get as much rain. As far as making water into wine, I guess one thing that you could try doing that I've done in the past with fish tank water, you know, using your city water, it's got fluoride and, you know, chlorine and a lot of other chemicals in there that aren't naturally occurring in rainwater. So that's probably one of the reasons, you know, plants do better with rainwater than your city water because, you know, they're not used to those chemicals. But one thing that you can maybe try is if you put your water into barrels or containers and let it sit outside for a couple days, sometimes a lot of those chemicals that are in there and some of the gases will kind of evaporate out, so it's not going to be just like rainwater, unfortunately, but that's probably one thing that you can try to make it a little bit more plant-friendly. Another thing you could do is put up some rain barrels underneath your gutters, and then every time it rains, you'll be collecting extra water. And we've seen here at the garden, too, that, you know, in the summer in a drought, you can water it all day, every day, even add some Miracle-Gro, and your plants just don't take off. But as soon as you get a week full of rain, you know, things shoot up overnight, it seems. So I'm not sure if VJ has anything to add to that as well.
I've been growing some geraniums for the past few years, and I've been overwintering them in my house. And I tend to agree with you that even my geraniums bloomed actually till end of November, actually. When it gets really cold, like less than 30 degrees or something, then probably I put up a floating row cover or maybe a plastic sheet onto it, and I can still, prolong its life. And in the springtime, if you do take a cuttings out of it, yeah, it's going to take a while actually to start producing the bloom. Probably you may going to expect bloom only by mid July or something. But, you know, when you do prune them, and if you still have the mother plant still in the container, they will start to produce some new leaves, and they will start to set some flowers right away. So I tend to keep my mother plant still actually in the container and move the container around in my landscape, you know, and that way I can still enjoy the early blossoms of geraniums actually, and that's one way. As far as with your city water, I mean, city water sometimes, you know, tend to have a slightly high pH. Maybe if you go to your local pet store, you can do a quick pH test, okay, because they have this kind of litmus test paper, and you can use it actually to figure out what your pH is. If your pH seems to be slightly high, then probably, you know, some of the plants like some azaleas and blueberries, they don't tend to like it actually. So it's best not to use those kind of city water in those kind of acid-loving plants. Rather, you can use it on your other vegetable crops or probably in your turf or trees and shrubs, you can think. But this year, you know, with all the rain that we got, I hardly think we have to water anything.
Well, I have some plants on my porch. It's a covered porch, and when it rains, I run outside quick and put them out on on the sidewalk so they get some rainwater instead of water from the tap. And they seem to like it. Whenever I do that, they seem to like it. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Joan, and I'm from Appleton. I've just been given this wonderful gift of many, many pots of raspberry bushes that were taken out because of a move. And I'm wondering, wanting some advice on how to replant those so that they'll at least survive. I don't expect them to prosper the first season, but is there some things I can do to help them survive?
The first question is, you know, is it a summer-bearing or say ever-bearing raspberries?
Ever-bearing.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm glad that your friend donated those plants to you. Sometimes I would be very careful because when you get donated plants, especially raspberries, okay, if it's been sitting in your friend's place for a long period of time, they can tend to harbor some diseases, especially some viral infections, you know. So, but if you're confident that you have a very good friend, then yes, okay, good.
It's actually my sister, so she's okay. in big trouble.
So, now, the first thing is that, you know, on your raspberries, make sure it gets a full sun. So find a location where it gets 6 to 8 hours of complete full sun. And second of all, find a spot, actually, you know, it's a bit of a dry area, not in a low-lying area. Raspberry roots are highly sensitive to root rot diseases. If it's, if it has a standing water for about 3-4 days, then probably it's going to have an issue. And then probably, you know, plant them in a row fashion. So you give about like, you know, 3 feet or 4 feet apart spacing from one crown to another crown, okay? And the key thing about raspberries is to train them actually, you know. So we have an extension publication on how to train your raspberry bushes, okay? So you go to, learningstore.uwx.edu website and type in growing raspberries in Wisconsin. You'll find the publication which gives you a detailed listings, okay, about training and pruning, you know, raspberries. So the first year, not a whole lot, okay, except that, you know, do some weed management. That's very critical. And so far we got plenty of rain, but in case if the July and August tends to be dry, then probably make sure to water them up really well. And in the fall, probably I'm talking about late fall, like in around Thanksgiving, cut all the canes down to the ground. Okay, because the ever-bearing raspberries produce the canes, okay, on the far and on the new wood, okay, we call the primal canes. So next year, those canes will come back, new canes will come back, and they will start to produce the flowers and set the fruits.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Let's go back to the phones for a minute and to Naomi in Madison. Naomi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm novice gardener here, just a couple seasons now with a vegetable and flower garden in our front yard because it's the only space that we have that gets sunlight. And last year, a neighbor used cocoa shells to mulch their garden, and it smelled really nice. So this year, I used cocoa shells, but shortly after I put the mulch down, a biologist friend of mine said, you know, there tends to be a lot of mold with cocoa shells. And sure enough, with all of the rain we've been getting, when I've moved some of the mulch to plant something new, there is a lot of mold there. So now I'm wondering what I should do. Should I try to remove all this mulch, and are my vegetables going to be safe to eat, my tomatoes and cucumbers that we have there? Do I need to do anything to try to remediate this?
Well, we've used at the gardens quite a few years back, we used to use a lot of cocoa bean mulch. And I found in my experience with it, like you said, with all this rain, it gets really slimy and kind of slippery, and you get those mold issues. One of the things you could try to do if you want to remove it, what I found here at the garden is if you incorporate it into the soil, usually it kind of helps break up that mold that grows in those big patches and gets all slippery. But I have noticed if you let it go this year and kind of deal with the mold, that actually next year you won't have those issues with the mold. That kind of the first season is where you see those issues with the mold growing, but by the second year it will incorporate into the soil a little bit better, and it actually improves the health of the soil in the spaces where we have used it before. I guess it's probably a personal preference if you want to go through all the effort of removing it all or not. But if you want to take like a garden fork or a pitchfork and kind of till it, you know, work it into your soil a little bit, that will probably help. I don't think you really have to worry about issues in terms of that mold being bad for your vegetables and your food that you're going to be eating. I haven't seen here at the garden where it's really affected the plants beneath it at all, as long as you have the mulch away from the base of the plants. If you have the cocoa bean mulch all the way up to the base of the plants, you know, you might have some issues with that mold, you know, affecting the crown of your vegetable plants.
BJ, is there something to add there?
Yes, I tend to agree with what Lithny has said, but one point I just want to add to you guys, that with all the rain that we got, let the soil dry out before you start putting any more mulch, because mulch tends to conserve the soil moisture. So with all the rain that we got, we want to actually make sure that, you know, all those, you know, saturated, you know, moisture in the soil gets evaporated, you know. So let it dry out the soil first, and then you start, you know, thinking about mulching it. Now, as Lindsay has said, you know, the mold is not going to affect your plant. So you don't have to worry about, you know, if there is a possibility of any contagious fungal disease going to spread from the mulch to the plant. So
there's been some talk about, some worry, I guess, about having cocoa bean shells if you have dogs, because chocolate cocoa is highly toxic to especially dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's just something else to kind of keep in the back of your mind, too. Thank you for that question. Let's take a question from the audience next.
Hi, I'm Marguerite from Green Bay. And about 4 years ago, I cut down a trumpet vine that I had just growing on a trellis. And now even 10 feet away from where it was, I'm getting shoots all over in the lawn. I did treat, when I first cut it, I sprayed it with Roundup, but is there any way to permanently get rid of this?
Keep mowing it down, for one thing.
Definitely keep mowing them down constantly, and that will actually weaken the root system. See, the root system is a key right up here. It's a storehouse of all the energy. So you need to deplete the energy stored in the root system so that the new shoots get weaker and weaker, and finally at one point, the plant will collapse down. The next thing you can think about, if you don't mind about your lawn, maybe you can do a spot spray with Roundup in the fall. Fall is a key time here, actually, because in the fall, probably I'm talking about like, you know, late September, early October, before the plant turns completely yellow, okay, spray them up. In the fall, the herbicides gets translocated into the root system, whereas in the rest of the growing season, it stays mostly on the leaf and shoot. So the leaf and shoot burns out, but the root is still alive and sends more shoots back again. So in fall, it sends it to the root and kills the root, okay? But you have to be extra careful because, you know, as you know, Roundup could also, you know, do a damage to your turf too, okay? So yeah. Maybe a spot spray, or maybe, you know, use some sort of like a sponge, and you can dip it actually into the Roundup solution, and you dab it onto the leaf and the shoot.
Thank you for that question. Let's take a call from Danielle in Madison. Danielle, hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call. So I have two questions about fruit trees. The first one is sort of just a general question. I'm calling from Madison, and I just moved back to the Midwest. I was living out west for a long time in the Central Valley of Washington State, where they grow a lot of cherries, mostly sweet cherries. And I noticed that most people here in Wisconsin grow sour cherries. Is there a reason why people don't grow sweet cherries more here?
Sure thing.
Yeah.
BJ, what about it? With you.
The sweet cherries in most part of the state of Wisconsin are not truly hardy, actually. Unless you want to give a shot by planting them in a protected spot, maybe you will have some good luck with that. That's one of the reasons why sweet cherries tend to be planted more in like in Door County area, because of the lake effect actually, you know, protects them actually, the shoots and the trunk from the, you know, fluctuating temperature. But I do see some few gardeners have planted sweet chili in Green Bay area, but mostly in a protected area. And if in case like in back in 2012, when we get this like in a very cold temperature of minus 20 degrees, then probably, you know, the sweet chilies could actually die back. You'll see a lot of shoot die back, and it become more prone to some bacterial canker and other kind of diseases too. So that's one of the reasons why sweet chilies are not so popular to us for backyard gardeners in most part of the state.
Lindsay, you don't have any growing here, do you?
We do have a sour cherry planted up by the cottage garden. This year it's looking really good. I think it was planted 2 years ago. But we have problems with the chipmunks. I have a peach tree, a cherry tree, and an apple tree that are pretty new. And last year I was really hopeful because I had lots of fruit on all of them. And I came back after a weekend and they were completely cleaned off. And that was the chipmunks. So I'm hoping this year they might be laying off a little bit. But we do have a sour cherry here yet. It has yet to produce fruit because of the birds and the chipmunks. But, you know, they have to eat too. So
there you go. V.J. Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Lindsay Hendricks, our other guest, assistant director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer back in Madison today. When I say back in Madison, I'm in Green Bay at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, with a great audience here and a couple of great guests as well. V.J. Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, and Lindsay Hendricks, who is the assistant director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And let's take another question from the audience. And I know Jill's got somebody all lined up. Hi, what's your name?
Good morning. Jack Lodgett from Fort Atkinson. Don't look so surprised.
All the way from Fort Atkinson.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah, right. A lot of the things that have happened, of course, with the sweet cherries, we found that the sweet cherries have been living much better. The little bit of climate change that we've had is just enough to make those things a lot easier to raise than otherwise. The question I really have, though, is when you're talking about planting new trees on this new building and this wonderful project you have here, what type of trees are you planting there?
Well, that is a very good question. We have all sorts of trees that are going to be going in, but one thing to note with the Grand Garden is we're kind of going with a holistic Andy Starr, Doug Tallamy theme of plants and trees and shrubs that are very insect and animal friendly to kind of be a little bit more sustainable and to show the public and other gardeners and visitors that you can have a really great landscape while also supporting the native flora and fauna that live in this area. So a lot of our trees that are going in, a lot of them are cultivars, but cultivars of native varieties that are native to Wisconsin, obviously. So we have a lot of oaks and maples. We have some tamaracks, some metasequoias, you know, a wide variety of trees and shrubs that are going in. And our director of horticulture, Mark, he was in charge of picking out all those plants. So he did a really good job of increasing the diversity of the garden, but also maintaining the holistic landscape design of the Grand Garden area. So I know we have over 100 trees and shrubs that are going in there. Fortunately, I don't know the names of all of them yet because I wasn't involved on the order list, but I just, you know, saw everything go through. So I know a lot of maples and oaks, I think some willows, a lot of trees that are native to the Wisconsin area. And just kind of going off that, you know, people think natives are, you know, messy and they don't really do much for the landscape. But once you guys see this Grand Garden, once it's complete, you'll see that you can still have a really nice landscape while having native plants that support the local flora and fauna of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Lindsay, have you run around the garden here and counted up all the trees you have and plants you've got?
That is a bad question for me because I know we have a lot of them, but the specific numbers, I don't know if we've ever pulled specific numbers just of the trees and shrubs alone, but if I had to guess, there's probably quite a few hundred different taxa represented here at the garden. And we do have some duplicates, but one of our main goals when we are increasing our collection is to get new and improved cultivars, so we're not having 500, you know, white oaks here at the garden. We have, you know, 500 different types of oaks in general. So
very cool. Well, let's take another question or another call, I should say. Ted in West Allis has something for us. Ted, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you very much. My question is, I planted some Japanese yews along the back of the house, and I kind of positioned them between the basement windows. Now, this is probably like 25 years back. They've grown a lot bigger than what I thought they would be. They're probably about 4 feet high, but they're also getting quite wide, and they're starting to block the light that goes into the basement windows. I'm wondering if I can trim off the bottom branches to open up to get the light into the basement, or would that, at this point, start to damage those plants?
BJ, what do you think?
I mean, you're not the only one in this situation. I've seen many Green Bay residents have some overgrown yews, actually. And then, I know, at one fine morning in the spring, they think about, I need to prune them. And where shall I start? See, yews are pretty resilient plant, okay? But the problem is, okay, if you do any drastic pruning, it may take years for them to come back. And so in a few years, you may have to think about and scratch your head. Maybe it's worth to have it or not, actually, because when you have that overgrown plant and you chop them, to quite a bit, it's going to look a little bit ugly, actually, because it's going to take a lot of time to, come back and fill in back again. But there is one thing you can do. You could do some gradual pruning. Instead of actually, pruning all at once, okay, maybe think about this one-third principle again, maybe, 1 year, if your bush is about 6 feet, maybe take 2 feet at the maximum. Maybe in the second year, further down, and third year, maybe further down, whatever the desired height and width you want. So in that way, your bush won't be too ugly, okay? That won't prompt you to remove them up, rather than actually, pruning all of it once right now and then probably regretting, I think it's best to take it out.
There we go. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it very much. And let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Margaret from Plover. And my question goes back to what you were talking about before, sources for trees especially. It seems to me that with the big box store rising, there has been a diminution in the number of trees that we can find for purchase locally. So I'm interested in knowing where the botanical garden gets their regular trees, not their dwarf conifers, and also what sources are you using for those 11,500 perennials that are coming?
Well, that's a good question because I am actually involved with that quite a bit. So as far as the trees and shrubs, the majority of our trees and shrubs come from Beaver Creek Nursery and also Johnson's Nursery. I think they're both Wisconsin-based. I'm not sure if the general public is able to order from both of those websites. They might just be wholesale only, but if you can go online to both of those websites and they'll give you some more information, some of the places that they do sell their inventory that you might be able to purchase for retail. We do have a couple smaller sources, where we don't get as much material from. Spring Meadow Nursery is another one. We do get a little bit from Clem Song Sparrow has a lot of unique and rare trees and shrubs. They don't have the biggest selection, but a lot of the really unique ones, and that is retail, so anyone can order those online. And those are the main tree and shrub places that I can think of right now. I know Mark is really good at finding all these little unique ones that, you've never heard of the place before, so I don't know the names of some of those. But as far as our perennials, a lot of them come from a place called W.E. Radke, which is also in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin. I believe they're wholesale only, but I think if you go down to their nursery, you can purchase plants from them. That's probably the greatest diversity of perennials that we have here at the garden come from there. We also get quite a few from Rush Creek Nursery. They have annuals and perennials. We also, this year with the Grand Garden, a great place here in Green Bay is Stone Silo Nursery. They specialize in perennials, and a lot of our perennials, are, sorry, native perennials, a lot of our perennials in the Grand Garden actually came from Stone Silo Nursery. So we do get other perennials from Clemsong Sparrow as well, Bluestone perennials, and I think that's a lot of the major ones that we have. Sometimes when we find these new cultivars that come out, there's very, they're not quite popular yet, so a lot of major retailers don't carry them. So you kind of, we do actually a lot of looking online, and sometimes we'll find these unique specialty retailers that have some of those products. So,
very, very cool. Before time gets away, I want to thank a lot of the people who have helped with this show and the groups, the Green Bay Botanical Gardens, Wallersheim Winery, Alpha Delights, Karina Abrago-Cook, Chris Myshock, Ellen Clark, Tom Blaine, Jill Nadeau, Chris Molina, of course, Dave Potratz, and Michelle Johnson. And it's always great to thank our guests as well during Garden Talk, VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, and Lindsay Hendricks of the Green Bay Botanical Garden. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, broadcasting today from the Green Bay Botanical Garden with a great group of people here in the audience and a couple of great guests as well. VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Lindsay Hendricks, assistant director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. They're doing a wonderful job. And if you have some questions for them, every one of our lines is filled right now, but you can join in, try to get there at 1-800-642-1234. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And we'll go back to the phones for our first caller here. Cheryl in Madison is up next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Okay. I have a very lovely maple tree in my front yard that I planted probably 15 years ago, maybe a little more. And at the time, I wasn't as, I don't know, wise or bright as I am now, and I thought I wanted a garden around it. So I made a bed around it and planted things there. And over the years, I ended up with some vinca minor in there and a couple of other ground covers. And, of course, now the tree is mature, and there's nothing I can do to work in there at all. And I'd really like to get rid of that garden around the maple tree, but I don't want to harm my tree. So I'm wondering what the best method might be or if it's even possible.
Yeah, those maple roots are pretty close to the surface.
Yeah.
BJ, what do you think?
Well, you're right, Larry. Maples are pretty shallow rooted. So when you had your perennial bed around those trees, you know, all those nutrients and good soil that you're thinking you're giving to the perennials, actually it's been robbed by the maple roots, actually. And now you came to a situation because the maple roots are choking out most of your perennials and not letting off those perennials to grow. So now you're in a situation that you want to, you know, move your perennial bed out of it. So probably your best thing is to try to scoop them out. Early spring is one of the best time actually to dig your perennials and to transplant it so that into a different spot so that it has a better chance to thrive in a new area. You can use a simple digging shovel or a fork, and you can try to scoop those plants out. We do have some perennials at the old extension office in the kind of same situation. Actually, we had it actually underneath the old honey locust trees actually. So I remember one of our master gardeners, and Bob Manjan, who passed away early of this year, he used to put some compost every year quite a bit around those perennials so that, you know, when the crown actually start to grow, it actually literally grows on the new compost area, not in the subsoil area, because the subsoil area is completely filled with the feeder roots of those honey locust tree. So if you're still having a doubt and you're sure that you don't want to remove them, probably wait till next early spring to scoop those plants out. If not, probably keep adding some more and more compost around to it. At one point, you know, maple trees, you know, tend to develop some girdling root issue, and they'll start to die back, okay, because of that. Maybe you can wait till then. Usually they tend to show the symptoms of girdling root when they get close to 25, 30 years, okay? At the time, you can take down your maple tree, and maybe your perennials will be happy by then.
You do need to watch a little bit about mulch, because if you put too heavy a mulch around those roots, you're going to create problems for the tree too, aren't you?
Absolutely. And now many tree roots actually tend to, you know, develop this girdling root or encircling root if they have too much mulch. We kind of sometimes become like a mulch maniac. And many times we see in a landscape, we kind of have this volcano mulch where the mulch bed is about like 6 inches or more than that, actually. But, you know, generally about, you know, 2 to 3 inch deep is good enough, and keep those mulch at least 6 inches away from the bark of the tree, because when the mulch touches the bark, you know, it tends to rot the bark too, okay? And you can spread as much as you want. Generally about 3 to 5 feet away from the trunk of the tree is really good.
Okay. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Julie from Green Bay, and it's really nice to have Larry Mueller here today. What a treat.
Thank you.
I have two questions. The first is regarding rose bushes. I've noticed a lot of black on the tip of the rosebuds. I think it's botrytis fungus, and I've been using garden soap on that. That's the potassium salts, some kind of thing. And I wondered if that was good enough. I'd rather not use a heavy chemical if I don't have to. And the second question I have is regarding the plant that I think scientific name is horrible harebell, or, oh my gosh, hideous horrible harebell, or it's otherwise known as bellflower, which I've been trying to dig out for several years now, going down a foot and trying to get all the roots out, and it just keeps coming back. I'm wondering if there's anything else I can do other than digging it out.
Yeah, there's the reason for that name, hideous. Well, Lindsay, let's turn to you first, and then we'll go to VJ.
I'll take the harebell question, because we have problems with that here at the garden. creeping bellflower, there are some cultivars of campanula that are a little bit more compact and contained, but as you know, some of them can be very, very vigorous, and there's no digging them out and controlling. So, you know, we try not to spray a lot of herbicides and insecticides here at the garden, you know, because we want to be green, but sometimes you need to bite the bullet if you're not able to get all those roots out of there, because the campanula, they spread by underground rhizomes, and if you take out that main plant, but there's still the little roots underneath the soil, you know, that can sprout another plant. So you think you got the big chunk of it, kind of what VJ was saying with that trumpet vine, you know, it just keeps creeping underground. Well, you pull out a clump, it's going to creep and go somewhere else. So, you know, there comes a point where you're sick of getting it out, and, you know, there's no end to digging it out. You just got to, you know, get some Roundup and spray it. That's probably your best bet if you want to get rid of it completely. Like VJ said, in the fall, you know, when the plants are translocating down into the roots is probably the best time to get it. What we do here at the garden is we, you know, have your little spray bottle, but if it's planted around other perennials that you don't want to kill, I usually take a piece of cardboard or even like an old milk jug that you cut the top and the bottom out so you have the handle as a shield, and kind of place that over your plant, and then you can spray inside of it, and then just your herbicide gets in that area where you want instead of killing out all your other perennials. And you need to make sure anytime you are spraying an herbicide that you're not doing it on a windy day, because you can get drift and that can affect other plants as well. So if you're sick of digging, that might be your best option, but just make sure you protect your other plants around it that you don't want to get nipped.
Good question. Pat, go to the phones again. Pat in Genesee. It's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, I love your show. Thanks for having me. I've got a question. I've got about 9 apple trees, and I have been very faithful in doing the dormant spray and the fungicide spray, and now I did the bug spray, and everything's been going well. And then the last couple of weeks, I've all of a sudden went out this week and saw a bunch of my leaves are shriveling up. They're turning brown. Some of the leaves have like an orange speck on them, and some of the apples are affected by either, I don't think it's an apple scab, but some other gross-looking stuff. And I was wondering, what can I do, or who can I go to get it figured out, if there's something I can spray or something?
Well, you know, when it comes to apple trees, it's a very high maintenance crop. You know, I know everyone likes to have apple trees in the backyard, you know, but you have to think about apples are highly succumbed to a lot of pests and diseases. And with all the rain that we got, actually, it kind of triggered a lot of diseases, actually. I mean, in fact, this year I've seen, besides the apple scab, I also seen like apple leaf spot. I never thought apple leaf spot is so problematic, but this is the first time I came across. And sometimes, and you also mentioned that you did quite a bit some spraying. Now, you have to be extra careful that a lot of times these apple sprays, they contain a combination of both insecticides and fungicide. And one of the common fungicides is a copper base. You know, you have to be extra careful that if you spray too much, especially if it's a hot, dry day, sometimes the copper could also injure the leaf of the plant and causes the leaf to turn brown, actually, too. So one thing I would say is to send your sample to your local extension office, take some pictures of it. And so the local extension agents, what we typically do is we take a look at the samples and see if it's anything related to disease effect or it is related simply to abiotic effect. And if it's related to a disease effect, we send it to our UW-Madison laboratory, Dr. Brian Hunnelson. He does all those kind of pathological testing, and he will send you a test report back again in 2-3 weeks, okay? Now, one thing you have to be also very careful is that, okay, don't blindly spray things, actually. Get to know what you're dealing with first, actually, before you start to jump your gun. So you also might not think about actually going to our learningstore.uwx.edu website. We have a wonderful publication on apple pest management for home gardeners. It gives you detailed information on for what kind of pest, what needs to be done, and everything is crucial based on time. If you miss the right timing, then there is no point in spraying afterwards, because when the damage is done, then what's the point in actually spraying after the damage is done, okay? So check out that publication, send your sample to your local extension office, get it diagnosed, and then based on that, you know, strategize, okay, when to take the right time to spray for those things.
All right, very good. Thank you very much for that question. Let's take one more call, and then we'll go back to the audience. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thank you for taking
What's
my call.
What's on your mind?
I had a question on apple trees and so forth that I planted. I planted about 5 of those late last summer. And I just wondered, how long does it take before you start to see fruit on these trees? Any information you can give me? I planted a variety of different types of trees, Fuji's, some green apples, and some different ones. 4 of the trees are dwarf trees, and 1 is full. It's going to be a full-size apple tree eventually.
Okay.
Generally, you should see the shoots and foliage and everything by now, actually. If not, probably you can blame it on the winter weather, actually. So generally, apples are best to be planted in early spring so that it gives enough time to get reacclimatized to the landscape and start producing the foliage and flower bud for next season. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I noticed that you said Fuji. Fujis, we do not recommend in Wisconsin because they do need a longer growing season, naturalized. So Fuji's are not a right variety here for Wisconsin. Same thing with Granny Smith too. I know everyone like Granny Smith, but what happens is that the fruit needs a longer maturing period, which in Wisconsin we don't have that. They need about 180 days. We have only about 110 at the maximum, let's say. Now, one thing about also apple trees is that you need to pay attention to the rootstock. So every rootstock has a bit of its own characteristics. So generally a dwarf rootstocks will start to trigger the blossoms in about second, third year. If you use a standard type of rootstock, you may have to wait about 5 to 7 years to wait for the blossoms, actually. So pay attention to the rootstock. A lot of people go just by the brand name, you know, like Honeycrisp, Macintosh, but they don't know what the rootstock these things are grafted. Some of the rootstocks have other unique characteristics, like disease resistant. You know, we all hate dealing with spraying apples, especially for scab diseases. So like some of the rootstocks, and they offer like, you know, fire blight resistant characteristic, also, you know, triggers the blossom even in the second year onwards, actually. So pay attention to those things.
All right. Thanks very much for that question. And let's take a question from the audience.
Yes, I'm Kathy, and I live near the Packer Stadium in Ashwaubenon. And recently, a few months ago, I had two black walnut trees removed from the north side of our house. And as many of you know, black walnuts give off the chemical jugolone. Mm-hmm. And through the years, I've battled which plants I could plant, which ones would die. But now I would like to put a tree in the center of the north side that would be fairly showy. I have magnolias on two sides of the house. They are affected by jugolone and anything within the drip line, which will take, I understand, 15 years to dissipate. Is that correct? And do you have a tree that would be real pretty, would not grow huge fast? I'd like something that would be a moderate sized and showy.
You're absolutely right. You know, black walnut trees tend to release this chemical compound called jugolone, which actually limits the growth of any other plants. And these jugolones can reside in the soil more than 20 years, even after you take down the tree, actually. In terms of some alternate species to plant in that area, I would refer you to our extension publication that we have a list of species which are tolerant and sensitive to jugolone. So you can go to the website called hot.uwx.edu. And in that publication, you will find some list of species. Some of the species in our old extension office, we had nearby the black walnuts or hackberry trees. Hackberries gets a little bit larger. But yellowwood tree, actually, it's a more of a medium-sized tree, and it seems to be doing perfectly well. You can also have some birch trees, too. But you have to be very careful with the birch trees. Birch trees do need some own unique climatic conditions, okay, because they like a cool, moist soil. Maybe it might be best because you were looking for on the north side of your property, so maybe it might do wonderful, you know, either river birch or maybe a paper birch might be good. As long as you maintain it very healthy, that might be also perfectly well. Now, there is another underused plant, actually, which is called Southern Sunflower. We planted it, actually, in a few years ago nearby the black walnut tree at the old extension office. It seems to be doing perfectly well. And I don't see any effect of jugolone affecting it. Even here at the botanical garden, they have a decent specimen of Southern Sunflower. It's a very gorgeous plant. I really like it because it has an exfoliating bark. And it is one of the rare species that blooms in the fall. So how many tree species bloom in the fall? And the flower fragrance is so, pleasant smelling. So even it actually gives out, you know, pollen and nectar actually for some of the bumblebees, you know, who are searching for the last minute actually before they hibernate, you know. They tend to forage around the Southern Sunflower. It seems to be hardy for a Green Bay area, so.
Very good. And let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Linda from Green Bay. I have a beloved plant, a hops plant that I grow on an arbor over my sidewalk. And I've had this plant for many, many, many years. In fact, we've nicknamed it Hopzilla because if we let it go, it'd be on the roof, in the tree, overtake my little corner garden there. My question is this year it's doing rather poorly. Usually it's very aggressive and very very robust, and this year I've got two little vines growing. Do hops plants have like a life cycle, or is this also being affected by all the rain?
I'm guessing it probably has a lot to do with the weather. You know, a few things this year are a little behind, not growing as well as they normally do. Some that are really water-loving plants, you know, are doing awesome. Specifically with the hops, BJ, do you have any experience with those?
I was trying to think if they're... They like a lot of nitrogen. They love plant fertilizers.
Generally, for hops, I think you know you can blame it on the weather conditions that we're having.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a lot of overcast in the sky, and plus you know the soil is saturated with a lot of moisture, and it kind of puts them behind the shadow. But it'll pick it up actually once we start to get a little bit of a dry season. It'll start to grow. Maybe if you want to boost it a little bit, maybe after it's done with the raining, as Larry has mm-hmm. mentioned, maybe sprinkle some little bit fertilizers and see what happens.
All right, thanks for that. Let's take a Tony in Racine has a call for us. Let's go to Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I had a question about any hazards associated with the use of bone meal to stimulate plant and root growth.
So bone meal, what do you think?
Well, bone meal is one of the organic fertilizers. It's rich in phosphorus, actually, and it's typically used to stimulate the roots, okay? So in the fall, when you plant all your tulip bulbs, you know, in a planting hole, you also sprinkle some bone meals, actually, and put your bulb in because, you know, it helps in better root growth. I haven't personally heard any negative effect, actually, affecting the plant growth, and if you apply a little bit too much. But, you know, generally, you know, don't sprinkle just on the top of the soil, and with all the rain that we're getting, actually, you don't want actually those fertilizers getting leached, actually, and getting into your storm sewer system. So make sure you actually rake it back into the soil, and just to prevent them from leaching into into your ground or into a storm sewer system. Lindsay, do you have any points to add?
I've heard the thing with the bulbs, planting bulbs, that it really helps. We haven't used it much here at the garden, so I don't really have any personal experience with it. But like VJ had said, with leaching the phosphorus into the groundwater, you know, that is an issue that we have and that we're dealing with these days. So you just have to make sure you work it into the soil so you don't have the runoff into the drains or the sewers or anything like that.
Yeah, that would be critical. And Innie, in the last half minute here or so, there are some special events. You guys, hundreds and hundreds of events, but what's coming up at the garden?
Well, we have a lot going on this summer. We have some great new events coming up. One that we are kind of expanding on this year is the BMO Harris Bank Getaway Wednesdays, which are every Wednesday from June 7th through August 30th. Kind of included in this whole day, we have cookouts from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., we have free admission from 4 to 8 p.m. We have a children's discovery station from 4 to 6 and a garden to glass cocktails and tunes from 6 to 7:30. This is a new event that we have on the patio back here.
And we're almost out of time.
Okay, then.
But go to your website. What's your website?
gbbg.org. Say that 10 times fast. GreenBayBotanicalGarden.org. gbbg.org. We have all of our information on there.
Lindsay, thank you so much for being with us. BJ, thank you so much as well. Thanks very much to our audience here at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's been a wonderful show, and I really appreciate you all being here with us. And just to mention, next week on Garden Talk, the Vicars of Vegetables. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.